All right, today is September 3rd, 2015. This is the third interview with Kaya Rebane?
Rebane.
Yeah, I apologize.
No, that's fine.
Maybe by the time we finally say our final goodbye, I'll have your last name down.
Seriously, don't worry about it. My family members say it wrong, too, so we all have a different way of saying it wrong because nobody can really say it right. Yeah. So.
And my name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So, Kaya, to make sure we have the sound quality where we want it, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Yeah. Kaya Rebane. Spell my last name. R-E-B-A-N-E.
Okay. I'm going to get this just a touch closer. You don't need to speak up. All right. So, we talked before we turned the recorder on. When we last met, you were talking about some events in the fall of 2009. And you've referred to some events sort of between fall 2009 and the uprising, but I think we want to try to get a bit more context. So chronologically, if you don't mind, maybe if we roll back to the fall of 2009 and go from there.
Okay, I think we went through the fall of 2009 last time, so maybe start at the spring of 2010?
Sure.
Okay, yeah, and I know that some of this stuff was discussed, so I'll try not to go too in-depth. But yeah, let's see, so the spring of 2010... I mean, there was the natatorium sic fi referendum, which I don't really think is necessary to talk about too much. I wasn't super involved in organizing around that, although I was to some degree. The biggest thing, honestly, in 2010 for me that took up a ton of my time was setting up a local group to work on... pushing for a constitutional amendment to undo the Citizens United Supreme Court decision by making clear, and other decisions that were preceding it, by making clear that corporations are not persons under the Constitution. They do not have constitutional rights, and money is not speech. And there had been, there were some folks that started organizing earlier than... So that Supreme Court decision was handed down on January 21st of 2010. And there had been some folks that started organizing a little before. And right after that point, I connected with some of them and said, hey, you know, I remember actually one meeting where I forget what it was about. I think there was some upcoming rally or event or something that was being discussed. And I just remember a couple of people, Ben Mansky and Lisa Graves, who are both local activists here in Madison, and, I mean, do progressive work more than just activists, although Ben now lives in California. But I remember meeting up with them and with a handful of other people and saying something to the effect of, well, I want to help out, but I'm trying to get my program done, so I'm not willing to do, like, a lot of on-the-ground organizing, but I think you guys should do, like, we should start focusing on organizing on the ground in different places, including here. Let's get something going kind of thing. And I don't remember exactly what they said about it at that time, but I was working with them, and then there was a conference sort of thing at the UW Law School that I know Ben Mansky was involved in setting up, and some other people I think were involved in setting up, which ended up kind of being a place, and it was focusing on the Citizens United decision and these issues, and ended up being a place where, I mean, I took along my friend, or invited my friend, I should say, Grant Petty along and met up with some other people there and ended up coming out of that kind of, I guess, leading or as an organizer, I hate saying leading in a way, but being, you know, playing a substantive role in bringing together an organizing kind of group to then found a local organization that ended up then being... A local affiliate of the national organization Move to Mend. And we launched our local group here. It was possibly the first of these local groups in the country, although officially it's a little hard to say. There were some folks organizing in Ohio and Colorado around the same time. And I was involved in, along with another member, I was on the steering committee of National Move to Mend from once we got our local group up and running, I was invited to join that. And I worked with one of the organizers, Caitlin Sapossi-Belknap, at the national level to, and actually as part of a committee, we co-chaired a committee that basically came up. I co-wrote the rules for, what the local affiliate structure would be and kind of what the requirements were and kind of helped set that up. I mean, it wasn't just me and it wasn't just Caitlin, but we kind of took the lead, and then the broader steering committee approved it, and then, you know, kind of went from there. So I helped write those rules, but then our local affiliate, we were busy doing a million things, and so I didn't really push us to get the paperwork done, and nobody else really took the lead. So it was a little, there was a bit of a lag before we actually became official. But regardless, we came together in, April, that conference was in April. Our local group's kickoff was in May of 2010. And we spent the summer trying to figure out what to do. I mean, at that conference, I remember speaking up and being like, hey, we should, you know, out of the different things that we could do, a referendum campaign makes a lot of sense, because that's a way, I mean, if from an organizing perspective, if you're going for something really, really huge, like a constitutional amendment, you need a few things. You need something to serve as an organizing focus in the nearer term, and something you can get near-term victories on and build your movement. Or at least that was my idea, that we should build the movement from the ground up, and that local referendum campaigns where local jurisdictions could actually go on the record calling for an amendment seemed like a good piece of an organizing strategy to me. So I was kind of advocating for that. And then the group that ended up coming together and forming the new organization also thought the same thing. They thought this would be a good thing. So we decided to go down that route. And we talked with some folks here in Wisconsin who had been involved in doing not exactly the same sort of campaign, but there was something, I think it was on the Iraq War maybe, or something, I'm forgetting, but talked with some folks who had some experience there. So anyway, we ended up launching this signature gathering campaign under Wisconsin statute. You can do, you can gather signatures for direct legislation, which previous court decisions have decided applies to non-binding referenda, and you have 60 days, and you have to get, 15 signatures equivalent to 15% of the people who voted in the last gubernatorial election to put something on the ballot at the municipal level, so at the village or city level. That's what that statute applies to specifically. So we said, okay, well, we're going to take on Madison first and then also try to get some other communities around Dane County and kind of go from there. And so we kicked off this campaign. I mean, we basically tried to plan it to overlap with a bunch of events in Madison where we figured we could get a bunch of signatures. And so ended up planning it for fall, which was fine in one sense, but it was basically the whole 2 months right before the November election in 2010. So that was not the best choice in hindsight at all, in part because Russ Feingold ended up in trouble and a lot of our activists went off to try to save Russ Feingold from in his race against Ron Johnson. And so we didn't have all of our activists that we started out with. We didn't have all of them by the end. That said, we spent, I mean, seriously, that 2 months at the beginning. So I was co-chair of this new local organization, one of the two, I mean, obviously two initial co-chairs. And in late summer, we had been talking about all this, and we didn't have much of a, we didn't have much of a structure. We had some folks in the organization that weren't very comfortable with hierarchical structure of any kind. And so there was this back and forth. And I want to say that the decision to even have co-chairs was something that happened right around the time of launching that signature campaign, kind of like, we need structure, guys. We need something a little bit more organized. And I remember at the beginning of that campaign, or right before it maybe, kind of looking around and going, oh my goodness, like kind of hitting me of how much we had to do and how much organization we were going to really need. So I ended up sitting down one night and just drafting a plan, a document, which I labeled, I think, something like draft plan to avoid chaos, I think, or something like that, and sent it out to all of our, like, our list and said, hey guys, like, we need to get more structure. Here's a proposal. And I think most of that ended up being adopted. And it basically involved a bunch of details that I don't know if you really want to hear about, but things like going to the local groups and doing going to local groups, different events where we were going to collect signatures, having point people for those events, having a person or people that would be like the storage location for stuff, because we had a lot of, you know, clipboards and pens and t-shirts and the petitions themselves, etc. we had a person in charge of compiling those events. We had people called location masters to like manage stuff, I think it was, point people at events, et cetera. We gave trainings to new volunteers at all of the events that we developed kind of just an outline for, et cetera. And a lot of events, I remember working with the local Move On group. Obama gave a speech, which was a great, that was the best thing ever, because I was juggling like 5 clipboards and just go down the line and like hand clipboards off and just go and collect the first clipboard and like pass it down. And everybody was like, oh yeah, first we'll sign. And et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of collaborations with different local groups as well as we asked people to download the petition and fill it out and mail it in as well. So there was just a lot of signature gathering, and I did a lot of the signature gathering myself as well. Like I was out, on with clipboards a lot of the time. I probably gathered about 4,000 signatures myself, which was about a quarter of what we gathered. So I actually was out there a lot. I basically got no other work done during these 2 months, except for maybe a minimal amount of stuff for my PA ship, but it was pretty minimal, and then I made that up later, but I had a pretty flexible timeline with that. So that was useful and helpful for me, because I wasn't TAing a regular class where I had to, put in 20 hours a week or whatever it was. I was in a more flexible position. But anyway, we almost got to our signature goal. We didn't quite get there. We had to, at the end. So if you didn't make your signature goal, you couldn't get it passed just based on signatures alone. The statute says that basically if you get enough signatures, then you take it to the municipality, the city council, or whatever, and they put it on, they can do one of two things. They can either pass it outright and just by a vote say, okay, let's adopt this resolution, or they can put it on the ballot for a popular vote. And that's what we wanted them to do, because from an organizing perspective, we felt like that was better, and from an public education perspective, that was better, because then we could go and educate people about the upcoming vote and do media work and all that kind of stuff. So that was our plan. We didn't quite get the signature goal, but what we did was we found a lead sponsor. He kind of found us, actually, Chris Schmidt, who was awesome. He actually approached me at a Dane County Dems meeting fairly early in the process and said, hey, if you don't get your signature goal and you need a sponsor, feel free to let me know. And he was great. And anyway, so we ended up getting it considered at the city council meeting and took in this huge stack of petitions and just kind of thumped them down. Everybody's eyes kind of got big, and there was not any problem with getting it passed with the way that we wanted, which is to put it on the ballot. The main complication that we honestly had was that during this process, we had also been working on other local villages and cities within Dane County, trying to get them to also have simultaneous referenda. And we were planning on then the following year going for the county level, because the county level you can't do by signatures, but we figured if we get a number of local municipalities, we can do the county next time, and then we have that many resolutions, right? We didn't want to go right to the county for a few reasons, but one was that we figured once the county did something, then the local municipalities wouldn't just go and duplicate it, or most of them probably wouldn't want to. So we wanted to wait. But there was a county board member who decided to take it upon himself, in consultation with a local constituent, to have a referendum in that same election on the same topic. And so we tried to kind of convince them to wait. That was a very weird and tricky and unpleasant sort of type of citizen lobbying, because you're asking them to wait, but you're saying, we really want this. We're really glad that you want to do this, but do you mind waiting till next year? And that message was kind of not all that clear. A number of county board members, I think, didn't immediately understand. And, we had to talk about that through, but then they said, yeah, but our constituents, what are they going to think if I vote against this? And, so it was just this kind of messy thing. The county board executive committee, I think, they considered it right before the full vote, and they almost actually, they clearly didn't understand some of the legal language, which, that's not surprising. But they almost took out the most key thing, which was the corporations don't have constitutional rights. And they almost took that out and voted to take that out, because one of the members was like, oh, well, I'm a lawyer and this isn't actually an issue. And we couldn't even talk at that point, 'cause we'd already had our public testimony section. And so we're all just sitting there like, oh my goodness, you got to be kidding us. But then somebody had come in late to the meeting. He voted to take it out, and then after a moment of consideration, he said, no, I vote to reconsider, because I'm not sure I really understand what I just voted on. So then they reconsidered and narrowly decided to keep that language, and we all kind of went, whew. So the language that they adopted was something that one of their attorneys, I think, wrote or at least helped craft, and it was less clear than our Madison referendum, which was our original language, and the voting patterns backed up that people didn't, and anecdotes as well, that people, they went to vote. We heard repeatedly from many people that, like, I was in the voting booth and the couple next to me was having a conversation, or there was one anyway, that there was a couple, and I guess they were having a conversation about, like, well, honey, like, should I vote for both of these? Are these the same thing or whatever? Trying to figure out whether that other, the county referendum was something to vote for in addition to the city one, or if they should just vote for one. So the city one got a higher vote total. And we had this kind of weird vote yes twice campaign that we ended up conducting to try to convince folks, hey, you should go and vote for this and vote for this if you happen to live in Madison and you're also in Dane County. Otherwise, just vote for the one. And so that was kind of weird and just awkward, but I mean, we did it, and we ended up getting the two pass both by very high margins. I think the totals were, oh gosh, now I'm forgetting, but the Madison, yeah, I'm trying to remember, I think it was like 84% and 78% or something respectively, but regardless, they were very high. And at that point, that ended up being a stepping stone to then do more of these across the state and across the country. And so a lot of folks within the state, we've now passed quite a number. I forget how many, 50 or 60 or something. And across the country, like hundreds. And many of those were via the ballot, not all of them. But here in Dane County, that was kind of the initial effort in that direction, and we were happy with that outcome because, I mean, it did pass by such a solid margin and all of that, and we did quite a lot of outreach and education and some pretty creative stuff that we felt pretty good about and then went from there. So that was kind of going on. I mean, right up to the election was our signature gathering period, and then the city council process happened after that, and the county board back and forth, that whole kind of mess happened near the end of the year. So that was taking up a lot of time. And then I was also working as a project assistant, studying the effects of various entrepreneurship programs on campus. So that was what my funding was from. I'm trying to think, I think I was taking classes too, although I'd have to check back and look. So there were multiple kinds of things going on. I was also working at the national level of Move to Mend, writing or helping write the organizing toolkit that we ended up using for a number of years and doing stuff like that. So there was just a lot happening that in 2010. And then our election, the election we got it on the ballot for was the April election, which was, I mean, intentional. We wanted it on the spring election so we'd be able to do more media outreach without having to compete with, you know, the governor or the president or whatever. So we, that was our, the April, the first Tuesday in April was the election. Well, that was 2011. So obviously that happened, like that election was coming right after the whole uprising stuff. So it was all kind of intermixed. So I was working on the Move to Mend stuff. And I don't want to imply, I mean, so I did play, you know, a substantial role in that. I don't want to imply that I was by any means the only one. There were a lot of people working on it. A lot of people that did really good work. That friend of mine, Grant Petty, he ended up being and still is actually treasurer for the organization, and he was very involved. And there have been, I mean, a lot of really solid activists, you know, have been involved. People that, in many cases, I got to know through that organization, and just some really amazing people. Like here in Madison and Dane County, we're really blessed to have a lot of really smart and strategic thinkers and hard workers. So that was all really positive, but it did take a lot of time that wasn't getting my dissertation or thesis, I guess, at the time done. So that was, let's see. So in addition, in the fall, so that's November 2010. And that was, I mean, the election that kind of set the stage for the uprising, right? The other things that happened in the fall was, one of the fellows who was involved in setting up Move to Mend, who I consider a personal friend, certainly, by this point in time, Ben Manske was running for Assembly, District 77, I think, against Brett Halsey. He was running as on the Green Party ticket, as I recall. Or maybe no, he was primarying him, so he must have been on the Democratic primary. Anyway, regardless, I thought that Ben would do a good job in the Assembly and was most of, or a good portion of my fall electoral work that wasn't on the signature gathering, which was taking up most of my time, was trying to help Ben win that nomination. Because once you get the Democratic nomination there, you kind of sail right through. Or maybe, you know, maybe he actually, that was the general. Never mind, I'm sorry, that wasn't the primary, that was the general. So, I mean, general by meaning that it was the actual election. So he was, I think he was running in the Green Party and Brett was in the Democratic, that's what was going on. Anyhow, so I did, like, for one of his lip pieces, I did this, like, elaborate sort of art piece for showing Ben's timeline through life as this path and stuff. And so I did some kind of artistic stuff there, and I canvassed for him and helped out with some of the, getting some of the endorsements. I mean, I know that, like, the TAA, we did end up endorsing Ben, which was a little bit of a back and forth internally, just because some folks didn't want to endorse the non-Democrat for fear of, I don't know, reprisals or whatever, I guess. But we ended up doing that, and Progressive Dane, that process of endorsement and such. So, which I didn't play a big role on that one. But anyhow, and then other organizations. So that was part of what was happening in the fall that wasn't the South Central Wisconsin Move to Mend or the Schwumpta stuff. Let's see, there was a seg fee campaign going on in the fall trying to lessen the burden of seg fees on graduate students. I was slightly involved in that, but it was kind of peripheral. I don't know, there's some educational stuff. Like, there was one rally for public education on October 7th, I recall. October 7th rally, that sticks in my head that I worked in organizing. But other than that, and then the New Badger Partnership, I think, surfaced sometime around that time, where Biddy Martin had been in conversations kind of behind the scenes with Governor Walker, I guess it must have been. Anyway, that was something that also kind of came up around that time. And CAPE was involved, or at least people in CAPE were involved in that. And I was part of a group of, like, organized labor folks that were kind of got together and would talk about this too and try to strategize. So that came up sometime around then. I forget exactly. I think that was fall 2010. So there was that going on, although that wasn't a major time during. That was something. And that might have very well been after the fall election. I can't quite remember. So there was all that. And then there was the, you know, results of the fall election, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you wanted to ask about that, but I'll just stop for a second and see.
I think what you just gave us right there was great in terms of sort of, again, providing more context as to your role as an activist up until the election. So I think the next question is, you know, the thoughts after the 2010 election.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, and it's kind of weird talking about this because, in the one hand, I don't know, I don't want to take too much credit for what happened. You know, I did definitely play a leadership role, but I want to definitely give credit to all the other people that made that happen too, because there were a lot of folks, and I just want to be really clear about that all that referendum and all that stuff. And I think everybody also, before I move on, everybody, you know, the folks in the city council, the folks in the county board, our different activists in different places, I think everybody was definitely trying to do what they thought was right to move the movement forward. We just had different ideas about the organizing side of that. So I want to recognize that, you know, the individual who is the lead sponsor on that county board referendum. Also, I mean, I think he's a good guy and everything. I don't, you know, harbor any ill feelings, but it was just this kind of weird, difficult thing where you end up with strategic organizing plans that aren't necessarily shared by elected officials, that's not really what they do. They do something else, and your objectives are broadly the same, but you understand how to get there a little differently in your role, if that makes sense. So, I don't know, I guess one of those learning experiences. okay, so reaction to the election. So I, at the, on election night, November 2010, I was over at the Great Dane brew pub, the one that's over by Hilldale. That's not really important. But I was at Ben Mansky's victory party, you know, as victory parties are, they happen whether or not you actually win. So I was over there, and Ben did not win, although he did a pretty good job for being a third-party candidate. But regardless, I just remember at this thing watching the, you know, TV in the Great Dane and watching the results come in from across the country, because obviously this, you know, this was November 2010. This was a midterm election with a lot of races happening. And I remember a lot of the folks there were kind of focusing on the national level results, and I was watching that too and going, oh gosh, this isn't looking good. But then I can't actually remember, I think that this was reported, I imagine it must have been. I remember being very depressed by the end of that thing, so I imagine that by that point we must have known that the Wisconsin, that Governor that Walker had won the governor's race, and that both of our legislative chambers had flipped to, or one of them had flipped to one of them, I think that was what it was. Regardless, we had like, there was a red tidal wave essentially that washed over Wisconsin, and I remember just, that was my thought, that, oh my goodness, we just, now we have Republican control, and really radical Republican control, because I already knew some of the folks in the state legislature that were, you know, the breed of Republicans that were kind of on the, that they were winning those seats were pretty radical kind of Tea Party types, right? So I just remember looking at that, those results, and just feeling like, I don't even know, just feeling terrified, kind of, I guess I would say. Just absolutely very dark. I went home that evening and changed my Facebook profile picture to black for mourning, you know, because of Wisconsin specifically. And a lot of the discussion was still about online, I remember. People saying, oh, you know, these are how the results happened across the country and this and that, and we lost these seats and whatever. But I remember there weren't a lot of people, or at least in my perception, there weren't so many people that were really focused on the state level. And I was definitely, I mean, I didn't have any idea how bad it would be. I remember afterwards sitting around with my best friend in a bar, and we were talking, and I mean, I was thinking, yeah, we're probably going to, within a few years, have right to work be the law in Wisconsin and this and that. But I mean, I didn't have any idea what was going to happen and how quickly it would happen. I mean, right to work actually technically took a number more years, but we got the equivalent for public unions quite a bit sooner than I had expected. And that Friday, it must have been the day after the election, or unless we waited another week, but I'm pretty sure it was the day after the election. Our next meeting with CAPE, we usually met on Fridays, and it transitioned over the years from meeting in an actual room and then getting beer afterwards to just meeting over beer. So that was, we usually just met in the Ratskeller in the Memorial Union. And I remember sitting around with the CAPE folks in the Ratskeller right after the November 2010 election, and just all of us just kind of staring down into our beer and just like at the floor and just being really depressed, because we had been working and making some good progress on some of our efforts up at the state house, or we thought we were making some good progress with some legislative goals we had. And we pretty much knew that at that point all of that stuff wasn't going to move forward anymore. And we just kind of sat there and thought, and we also were scared about what else was going to come at us now that we had these very radical right-wing legislators in control with a radical right-wing governor. So we were pretty depressed. That was a very depressing meeting, which I remember quite clearly, at least the tone of it. I don't remember the exact conversation, but I remember just all of us sitting around and staring into, you know, staring and not saying a whole lot and just being kind of shocked, right? And there were conversations fairly soon after the election that started among various activists. I remember Ben Mansky being one of them, but not the only one, about how we were going to resist once Walker was in the governor's office, because we assumed he would do different things. And I was kind of at the position, well, you know, yeah, we should start thinking about this, but honestly, we have to see what he's going to do. Maybe he'll surprise us and he won't be as bad as we think, which obviously didn't happen. Yeah, that was kind of my recollection there. I mean, and Walker did start doing stuff, of course, before he even got into office. I mean, the main thing there that I remember was there was a high-speed rail line that the federal government was trying to, you know, had stimulus money to offer to help build a rail line from Milwaukee to Madison. Then it was supposed to go up to Minneapolis from Madison. And Governor Doyle had been, well, I don't really remember what he said before this, but he basically hadn't really accepted it, and or at least hadn't, I don't know, he hadn't done whatever had to be done to accept it. And Walker, who wasn't even in office yet, basically said that he didn't want this money. He didn't think that, you know, the federal government, which was pretty much like free, more or less a free rail line that we would have to maintain to some degree. But I mean, it was just this big amount of money to do this project that honestly would have been an economic stimulus, would have done all these other things. And Walker just was like, no, we don't want that. And Doyle pretty much just caved and said, well, I'm going to respect that and not, you know, go forward on this in my lame duck term. At least that's my recollection. And I remember one rather cold rally in, I don't know if it was December, I don't think it was January, it's probably December, I'm not sure, you know, about a high-speed rail-focused, like, demonstration, mm-hmm. saying, Walker, you know, it's, like, let us have a train or whatever it was. So I remember that, but I mean, we had no idea the rest of the nasty stuff that was going to be coming our way, of course, at that point. Let's see, early in 2011, before the uprising, too, we did have, like, on January 21st, we had a one-year anniversary for Citizens United, which was possibly the coldest rally I've ever attended, with one potential challenger. There was a really cold rally outside a hospital a number of years ago, but it was really cold. It was, like, at night on January 21st outside the Capitol building. And I was speaking. John Nichols was speaking. I remember Grant Petty was doing sound for that. And Grant had his gloves off, and I don't know. Like, he almost got frostbite. I think, like, he was really cold. It was just really cold. And we had maybe 50 people there, which we felt at the time was a really good job, because before the uprising, you used to get, you know, 50 people, and you're like, yeah, that's pretty good turnout. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was completely ruined by the uprising for a lot of us, because now we're like, yeah, whatever, you got 1,000 people, like, whatever, that's nothing. But we did that, and we felt pretty good about the turnout, and then we did a week for democracy over at the Irish pub across the street, and a lot more people came to that, not too surprisingly, because it was warm. And there was, you know, there were drinks and things and food. But, yeah, so we did that. And then pretty much that was late January, and it wasn't all that much longer until, well, the stuff that led to the uprising came along, right? Because by that point, Walker was in office and doing some, you know, getting going on. Well, one of the first things he did was give a bunch of tax cuts, as they recall, to various special interests and what have you, that actually ended up being pretty similar in size to the budget deficit that the budget repair bill or the budget despair bill, Act 10, was supposed to address. But that's not really my personal, that's just stuff I remember, although I know it's out there in the historical record otherwise, so.
Right. So then the next thing really is your memories, if you have them, of when you heard about the budget repair bill.
Yeah, I definitely remember that. Let me see. I guess stepping back a little bit. So that semester I was still working as a project assistant for that entrepreneurship stuff. I was also working as a grader for a class in applied economics, so I was doing those two things. And I, one of the things I was still, as I had been pretty much since 2006, I was still on the TAA's Political Education Committee, or PEC. And we were planning an action for Valentine's Day. So that had been in planning. I mean, it was originally focused on, and I mean, still was kind of focused on the UW. It was supposed to be about Governor Walker, have a heart, you know, don't cut UW funding, that kind of thing. Of course, that got kind of repurposed because it was... that protest was on Monday, February 14th, which was right after shortly after the bill was announced. I had been involved in planning that action, although I wasn't certainly chairing that committee or anything. The chair at that time was Peter Rickman. And on Thursday, February 10th, so the day before the thing was announced officially, I think it was, There were two emails, and I can't remember which one I saw first or which one came first, but there was one that Peter Rickman sent And there was one that Brian Kennedy, who was at the time our AFT Wisconsin president, sent. And they both said, hey, there's a bad thing coming. And Rickman's, at least I remember, was he'd seen a draft, I guess, I think anyway, he'd seen a draft or something of the bill, or at least had some intelligence from somewhere, some folks in the Capitol that had seen a draft. And so he enumerated what a number of the things that were in there, including the proposed basically gutting of collective bargaining for public employees and restricting bargaining to only allowing you to bargain only up to the rate of inflation and only on wages, and getting rid of collective bargaining rights, I think, for, you know, a number of worker classifications, including faculty and academic staff, which we had just recently won before that, and et cetera. So it was quite a lot of details. And I saw that, and I just went, oh, my goodness. And that was sometime, I think, on the afternoon of February 10th or the early evening. I'm not sure exactly the time. I mean, I could look. But anyway, so that was Thursday, and I wanted to get the word out about that. I was actually leaving town, I think it was early the next morning, like really early, to Detroit for my uncle's, I think it was 80th birthday party. So I was like leaving for the weekend. But I thought, oh my goodness, I want to get the word out about this because this is really important, really terrifying, and whatever. So I put up a diary about it on Daily Kos, which I've never been a huge blogger, but I would post periodically on there and what have you. So I threw up a diary that evening on there basically saying that there's this proposed thing. It's going to be announced tomorrow, I think, or whatever, and here's what's in it, and this is the result of the recent election. Elections have consequences, and we need to do something to stand up, fight back, or whatever, something like that. I mean, it's still online, so it's out there. But anyway, so I did that and posted that, and pretty much then, I think, just went to bed, slept a few hours, got up, and got on the plane. Over that weekend, the TAA was organizing phone banking, I think, and, I mean, the PEC was kind of taking the lead, and Peter was very involved in that, and trying to recruit people for the Monday action, I think, and doing some other stuff. But I wasn't in Madison, so I wasn't myself doing that. I was in Detroit, or the Detroit area, stuck on my computer a lot of the time, like watching from afar what was going on and the news coming out. Obviously, it was a family gathering, so I wasn't part of that. I actually was being a good family member and actually participating and what have you. But I admit I was pretty glued to the computer for a lot of it and watching what was going on. So then on Monday, February 14th, I got back in the early evening, and there was an emergency GMM, a general membership meeting, that had been called by the TAA for that evening, and I happened to be getting back right before it. So I got off of, I mean, I remember I got off of the bus coming from probably Milwaukee or something, I forget, wherever my plane came in, and I got off the bus at Memorial Union. I was hungry, so I walked over and got a burrito on State Street, and then I walked right back with, you know, my bag in tow and went right to the GMM, because it was, I think it was in Humanities, which is really close by. So it was pretty much like right from the bus. Besides dinner, I just went right to the meeting, right? And one thing that had come out late on Monday at some point was that, oh, and by the way, I did post actually a handful of diaries on the same, on Daily Kos during the occupation there were, and before, obviously. So I had a few things that I wrote at the time, which I did go back and glance at and you know, skim again. So like some of this stuff is, I probably wouldn't have remembered some of these details if I hadn't done that, but I put them down in writing at the time. So anyway, there is, late Monday, it was announced that there would be a hearing in the Capitol building, or at least that's when I got word of it. That's what when I heard about it. I think in Monday is actually when it was announced, though, and it was announced by posting, as I recall, a single piece of paper somewhere in the Capitol, and I heard about this from somebody else who had been in the Capitol and seen it. So this met the requirement for public notice technically, but of course is like the worst way in, you know, this age of the internet and everything else to actually announce something, especially something this important. So I think that they expected to just put up one little announcement about this hearing and not have hardly anybody notice it, and then have the hearing wrap up pretty quickly and then be able to move on to a vote. But one thing also that was clear by that point anyway, by Monday afternoon or evening or whatever, was that even though there was only this one piece of paper hung up in the Capitol, there were these right-wing groups that had already arranged buses to get people to Madison to testify. So clearly somebody had been told before, it just wasn't the public. You know, so Americans for Prosperity and the Club for Growth were two of those at least that had at least reportedly already reserved these buses to bus in their members. And so going into this general membership meeting on Monday evening, I was, a couple of things. I was really concerned, number one, that these groups would get to testify and that our people being the public, people on our side of the issue wouldn't get to because they wouldn't know about it. And so I wanted to, at that time I didn't honestly, given the composition of the legislature and the governor was Scott Walker, I wasn't honestly thinking that we probably had much chance to actually stop the legislation at that point. But I wanted, I did definitely want to make sure that we got as many people on the record as possible against this thing, so it was clear that this wasn't something that the public was in favor of. Also, I'd been involved in certainly JFC hearings before, and the hearing was supposed to, as hearings usually do, they go, well, maybe not always, but the hearing is supposed to go on until people are done testifying generally. And so I was also kind of thinking, well, if we don't get people to the hearing, they can wrap that up pretty quickly and move on. But if we can get a bunch of people to go and testify, then at least that'll give us a little bit more time to organize and try to, push back and do something, right? So at that GMM, I remember making kind of a pain in the butt of myself to some degree, I think, because the conversation was about a number of different things. And certainly the upcoming hearing was one of them, but it wasn't, based on my recollection, really the main focus. A lot of it was more about trying to do organizing phone banking and trying to convince, I forget exactly what it was, like reaching out to different legislators and things like that. But I was just like, no, we need to get people there to testify. We need to do this. We need to, and I'm willing to go there first thing in the morning and be a point person, and we should do this. And it's not like other people were disagreeing or anything or that nobody else was thinking about this, but I do remember repeatedly being like, no, hearing, like that's what we should focus on right now. And afterwards I went up and talked to the co-presidents and said, listen, I'm really tired because I just flew in from Detroit, but like I am willing to be this like one of the contact people first thing in the morning who else wants to go and whatever. And so anyway, one way or another, we ended up, and I don't want to say that like I'm the only one that was thinking this direction, to be very clear, but I do remember feeling a little guilty about being kind of really fixated on this particular point. Anyway, so a number of us got to the Capitol early before the building opened at 8. And there was a little crowd of people that were kind of assembling on the State Street side, I think it was. And I wanted to see if, I was still concerned that these people that were being bussed in would get in line first and that, we would not, I don't know, it's probably, I just wanted to make sure that we had some people in line that were, early enough that we were definitely going to be able to testify. And so I went around to the other side of the Capitol building to see if I could get in there yet, because it was probably like 6:45 or maybe a little earlier than that. 6:45, I'm sorry, 7:45 or so, something like that. And there was somebody that at one point went in, I think it was probably a staffer, although I don't know. And so I kind of just slipped in behind them and went up to the hearing room and sat outside of it. And there was like at that point, like nobody else was in the building from at least, our people, because I wasn't supposed to be there either yet, but I just wanted to make sure that we had somebody in line. And I remember there was a police line that walked past while I was sitting there by myself, and they kind of were looking at me. They're all marching past and kind of looking at me with this kind of quizzical look on their face. And one guy said something like, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And I remember saying something like, "Oh, I'm just really excited to be able to testify," or something. He kind of gave me this weird look and kept walking, but they didn't bother me. So technically, I could claim to potentially be the first occupier of the occupation, although it's not really important in any real way. But I was in there earlier than I was really technically supposed to be. And I did have to leave a couple of times, so I definitely wasn't... I don't think I even signed up to testify first. Once I was there, I was like, well, once other people started arriving... I think they also... They ended up shifting the line to the other side, but regardless, so... I ended up not actually being certainly the first to testify. I also had to leave a couple of times because I was interviewing young entrepreneurs for my PA ship and had some of those set, and I think I had some other meetings or something, so I had to leave and come back a few times. So, and I also went outside for the noon rally on that Tuesday, right? So I came and went a little bit, and I didn't actually myself testify until later in the day. And let's see. So do you want me to stop for a second? Because I'm just kind of talking, and I don't know if you want to.
No, this is fine.
Okay. I tried to kind of think through what goes in what order. So, and at least for this early period, that was easier. Later on, it gets harder because things start to blur together a little bit more. But okay, so this hearing. Those folks, or at least somebody, clearly did bus in right-wing supporters. They all came more or less at once, as I recall. There was a set of actual reserved signs on some of the prime seats in the hearing room, which you're not supposed to do, about 30 seats. And this is from a diary I posted shortly thereafter, so that's where I'm getting these details from. There were reserved signs in about 30 seats, and those were there until the public part of the testimony was about to start. And then there was like this crowd of right-wing activists that all kind of came in together and sat down in these seats. And the Democrats on the committee on the JFC asked the Republican leadership about this. They said, there's these people that have been waiting outside for how many hours, 2 or 3 hours or whatever it was by that point. Because usually in these testimonies, you have people that are invited to testify go first, and the public part comes later. So that's why there was this delay. And the Republican leadership, I remember, and I wrote this down, claimed that they were just trying to accommodate people's schedules, right? Which was clearly ridiculous, as we all could tell, because a bunch of us had been reading like 3 hours in line by that point, and none of us got any kind of accommodation like that. The accommodation was for a very specific type of testimony that was in favor of this bill. And this bill, of course, it wasn't only about collective bargaining, as I think, but a lot of times the conversations, I think, around the uprising and around Act 10 end up being, oh, this is about just collective bargaining. Well, actually, no, it had a lot of other really bad stuff in there, too. So the testimonies that ended up happening in the hearing weren't all about labor, or unions. They were about other stuff, too. Anyway, so that little crowd of people ended up testifying and then leaving, and then it went back to everybody else. And aside from that one little group, my recollection is that just about all of the testimony, and there's got to be somebody that was in favor of it, but I don't remember, hardly anybody. It was just almost all against this bill. So that hearing, like I said, I came and went a bit during the day, but the hearing kept going, as I think you know, to really late. It kept going into the night. And the Republicans ended up quitting at about 2:30 a.m. is what I had written down at the time, so something like that. That they decided, we said we were going to let everybody testify and keep it going until everybody had testified, but we changed our minds. We want to go home and sleep, so bye. We're shutting it down. And a bunch of us filled the hallway outside the JFC hearing room at that point, just chanting that we want our chance to get heard, et cetera. And it was quite loud and quite a lot of people there. And that went on for quite a while as they were inside trying to, I guess, figure out what to do or whatever. At one point, I think it was Lena Taylor. I'm not positive, but I think there was somebody who came out to speak to us from the JFC and okay, well, we're working on it, whatever. But they didn't manage to keep the Republicans there, certainly. The Republicans ended up leaving. And later that night, the Democrats held a press conference. I don't even know what time it was, if it was 3 in the morning or something. I'm not even sure, but it was in the middle of the night in the rotunda, I think on the first floor of the rotunda, held a press conference to announce that they were keeping the hearing going so that everybody would have a chance to speak. Of course, from that point forward, it was only the Democrats. The Republicans moved on to go and talk about passing the bill. Well, first they went home and slept, then they came back and they were meeting separately. But the Democrats were no, we're going to keep the hearing going. So the hearing kept going through the night, and I was one of the people, there were a few of us that were trying to keep people testifying. I mean, we were texting people asking, hey, come to the Capitol, asking people not to leave. And I forget exactly, but I think how it was that you signed up and then they announced that you were up, going to be up soon or something. So you had some kind of announcement made that, get ready, you're almost up or something like that, which has not always been the case in hearings since then, certainly, but there was something like that. And anyway, so we had people keeping it kind of up, listening to who was getting announced, and then coming down, and we would try to find the people that were getting announced and make sure that they were awake, because there were people sleeping on the floor, and trying to make sure that they were ready to testify, and then if people were wanting to leave, we were saying, oh, no, please, you know, can you stay another couple hours, and texting other people. So trying to basically, you know, keep the hearing going, in part, honestly, because, well, in part because we wanted to make sure people actually spoke that wanted to speak, but also we knew that by that point there were other folks, like other unions and such, that were organizing their members to come in the next morning to be able to speak. Other people clearly wanted to have, you know, a say on this too, and a lot of people didn't know there was any hearing going on until it was already going on. And so part of it was like, okay, we need to keep people testifying up until, I forget if it, you know, 7 in the morning or 8 in the morning or whenever it was exactly that we were expecting those other buses to arrive. And so I was up basically the whole night. I got about half an hour sleep, like right before, like right at the tail end of that, like at 6:30 or 7 or something. I slept for like half an hour and was very tired. there were about 1,000 people, I think, at least based on my estimate at the time, in the Capitol that night. So it was a pretty good crowd, but obviously it got bigger later. Let's see, backing up a little bit also. So that night, or like late, I think it was late the afternoon or maybe early evening, the TAA, and I think also SLAC, the Student Labor Action Coalition, and maybe some other groups, I'm not sure, had sent out a call, like a text, I think it was, or something. Basically a call to ask people to come and do a sleep-in at the Capitol. So that had been announced, and they were asking people to come. So I wasn't, it wasn't like, you know, I was the only one texting people or anything like that. No, definitely not. And so people were arriving, you know, based on that call, and people were spreading the word. So this was kind of going. And that was the first night of the occupation, of course. And let's see, so... yeah, so I was really, really tired by Wednesday morning, right? Like, I was really bleary-eyed. Somebody took a photo of me that morning, and you can just see, like, I'm just totally tired. And the hearings, of course, kept going on throughout that day as well. And they broke up later, or broke when, I forget, like, if it was that afternoon or whatever, but then they resumed again later, like, the Dems called them again. And so they went on more or less continuously for at least, what, 3 days or something like that, I forget exactly. But, of course, at some point, Friday, I think it was, maybe, whenever it was that the senators left for Illinois, then, of course, they weren't at the hearings anymore. It was just the assembly Dems by that point, if I recall correctly. I mean, I'm sure I know that they were, all the senators were gone, so, and I think that that overlapped at the time the hearing was still going on, although I'm sure you have the record somehow. This is the thing. Some of this stuff gets a little hazy after a while. Okay. Should I keep going? Because I got Wednesday now, and
right.
I keep going in order.
Let's go with Wednesday, and then let's see where we get from there.
Okay.
In terms of time, because we got a few more minutes. So
okay,
let's go while you're on a roll.
So. While I'm on a roll, well, I could probably keep talking for a lot longer. So, okay, so Wednesday, February 16th. So I remember, my own recollection that day. Like, I remember that day more than I remember most of the days of the occupation. And part of it was, so that was the after the first night of occupation, right? So it was kind of this new thing. Like, I hadn't been living in the Capitol for 2 weeks by that point. And I really remember the noon rally that day. I remember going outside before the rally and standing on this, like, kind of frozen hillside, like, right outside the Capitol, and watching people come, like, assemble. And the day before, it had been... give or take 10,000, I think, on Monday. And that day, it basically doubled up to 20,000 or something like that. And there were teachers, I think, calling in sick by that point and whatever. But regardless, there was this crowd that was building, right? And the previous day, on Tuesday, I remember feeling, you know, just the predominant feeling was angry and sad and just feeling like I had to fight this thing and that we all had to fight it, but that it was a losing battle. And... that day on Wednesday, just standing on that hillside, I remember, like, starting to feel hope as I was watching all these people come, just, like, looking at this, what, of course, the crowds got bigger later, but to me, that was a lot of people. I mean, it was a lot of people, like, 20,000 or whatever it was a lot of people. And I started really feeling a sense of hope, like, you know, we have power, and I started really feeling that sense of collective power. And I posted a blog that night, or a blog, a diary that night, describing that. By that point, also, there were people talking about I mean, people were talking about all kinds of things by that point. I mean, I was having some conversations about different forms of civil disobedience, and other people were as well. I mean, and I mean, this is a form of civil disobedience, I guess, but there's also talk about strikes. People were talking about recall elections already by that point. So there were these conversations were starting to happen, although not necessarily in a super organized way yet, but that sort of thing was already being discussed. I don't have any distinct memories of that third day, honestly. I mean, I know that I was, those first few days I was in and out more than I was later. I mean, I was, during the occupation, I was there for the vast majority of it, but I did have some, in those first days I had, had some interviews set up for my PA-ship and things, because, of course, I didn't realize that I was going to be, in the Capitol the whole time when I set those up the week before or whatever. And so I had to kind of come and go to do those and would go home and shower, once a day or so and come back. Because at that point you could come in and out of the Capitol freely. They weren't restricting that. But on Friday, by Friday anyway, there was definitely infrastructure coming together. And again, I posted something on this, so I know that was the case. I mean, and that's one thing that maybe in the next interview we could talk more about. But there was... there was this really powerful feeling of community within the Capitol. I mean, there were people outside the Capitol, too, and there were these rallies that kept happening that a lot of people attended. And, of course, those of us inside the Capitol would oftentimes go out for the rallies, so there were plenty of, I had a lot of, times when I was out in the rally. I remember my feet getting very cold and wet because I was mostly wearing my Chuck Taylors and they weren't really winter shoes. But there was just this feeling of community, and there was this infrastructure that came together that was very non-hierarchical but really worked, where people were just helping each other out in all kinds of different ways. And it really had such a different feeling, such a contrast for me to my previous experiences being in the Capitol, because I had done quite a bit of citizen lobbying. And the Capitol always felt really kind of cold and somber and serious, and confusing. I remember always getting lost. I'm trying, you always have to get to a meeting early to make sure you actually could find the right room. And that didn't actually change during the uprising. I still get lost in that building. I still can't find offices on my first try, but regardless. But the feeling was very different. And by that Friday, there were businesses that were stepping up to offer food, and people had formed teams of folks to clean up. I mean, and part of that was being organized by the TAA, but not entirely. There was a drum circle that had kind of established itself in the rotunda. There were a couple of brothers who have been involved in a number of local things since then, Damon and CJ Terrell. And I think I still have in my phone Damon, labeled as Damon the Drum Whisperer, in my phone because of this. Helping organize. Not actually delivering, but organizing civil disobedience legal rights trainings and civil disobedience trainings in conjunction with some folks from the Grassroots Leadership College. And I was mostly organizing to make sure people would be able to get there, and trying to make sure we had people's legal information who are staying overnight, so that in case we all got arrested, that we would be able to do jail support type stuff. But anyway, one issue that we were having was when we were trying to do these trainings in different parts of the Capitol, you couldn't really hear very well because there were this drum circle going on. And also, when you got later, people wanted to sleep, and so there were these drums. So Damon was, I guess, the person that I first figured out that I could talk to him, and he could make the drums get quiet if we needed them to. So that was why he was the drum whisperer. And CJ was his brother, or is his brother. And by that Friday, there was also, I know by then, the firefighters were, coming into the Capitol with their bagpipes, and that was especially initially. I mean, after a while, you got kind of, you'd heard the bagpipes enough times, you're like, oh yeah, the bagpipes. But at the beginning, I remember just this real sense of solidarity and hope. And I mean, it's not like that went away, but this idea that, the firefighters aren't actually included in this bill. They were exempted, but they're in those, the same for the cops, but that they're coming in here in this very obvious show of solidarity, and just this really beautiful show of solidarity. And there was a lot of excitement and just sort of good feeling about that. So I remember that. We also, and I could talk more about this, I don't know how long you want me to go, but so the TAA obviously played quite a bit of role, especially in the early part, organizing stuff. And it was one of the hubs, not the only one, but a major hub within the Capitol for the first part of the occupation. We had a control room, or we call it the war room or the situation room. We had this like control center set up. That was really, I'm not entirely sure who arranged to get that space. I'm kind of guessing it was Rickman, but I'm not sure if that's right. I think you interviewed him, so maybe he mentioned that. But regardless, there was a lot of people involved in different aspects of that space and what it was and how it worked. It was really basically this big hub. And it included, at the beginning we had internet access through the Capitol itself, because there's a wireless network. It doesn't work great, but it works. But then we ended up setting up a wireless internet connection, separate one, for that room. And especially, I remember at one point the internet got shut down and then we got it back. And I can't remember if that's when we switched to the wireless or not. But regardless, one thing about it was that we had like a media kind of work area, media station set up in that room. And so people were on, you know, using the internet, getting stuff out to the press and getting stuff out, blogging and out to other people to make sure that we were getting our side of the story out there. There was a food area set up outside where people were bringing in. I mean, at one point, one of the many restrictions that were enacted were like no crock pots are allowed in the Capitol, and I'm sure that was because part of what we had out there were crock pots with food that people would bring in, and then we could all, you know, different whoever whatever protesters were around could come and have food. I mean, this was something that wasn't restricted to TAA members. Certainly, it was a lot of people working in there were not TAA members, but a good number were too. There was also the war room was a place that we coordinated marshaling. So we had volunteer marshals to keep the peace. And so people could come and sign up, and there were vests that they kept. And there were some people that were in charge of that. Bill Fetty, I know, was one of them, although not the only one. In that early stage of the occupation, because this war room didn't last for the whole occupation. We did get kicked out of it eventually. But we had a place to keep like sleeping bags and pillows and stuff along the side. There was a place to post notices about things that people should know about. we had like at least one legislative map on the wall, I know, where there was some kind of legislative coordination. There were also people over in the TAA office, and I think maybe down at the Labor Temple, the Madison Labor Temple. But there were people anyway off-site doing phone banking and legislative kind of focused stuff. And so there was coordination from the war room to those folks as well, and some back and forth there. And later on when when the internet access got more difficult and stuff, I think more stuff moved out there. But regardless, there was that. The war room also functioned as a place to, find people in a general sense to fix problems. There were a number of us that kind of played that role that, you know, people would run into the room with some crisis or something that was happening, like, oh my goodness, this is happening, and just kind of look around and try to figure out, like, who here is somebody who could solve problems. So there were a number of us that would end up just kind of getting dragged out to fix this or that or the other thing as it happened. So it was kind of chaotic, but it worked. There was also a sign up at the beginning anyway for people, TA members and others, to sign up to come in and do overnight shifts to make sure people were there, although later on there was this constant kind of occupation, and I'm not sure that sign-up sheet persisted, but I know at the beginning it was there. And there's a bunch of other organization. If you want, maybe in another 5 minutes, maybe I can talk a little more about organization and then kind of wrap it up for the day.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so there were these multiple hubs, right? The war room was definitely a big one, and it was an early one, and it lasted for, I'm not entirely sure how long, but I feel like it was maybe a week or so, or... It feels like it was years, but it was not years because everything kind of stretched out. It was kind of a timeless feeling in many ways. But another hub that I'm not sure exactly when it got set up, but was this information station that was located down by the rotunda on the ground floor, I want to say. Maybe it was the first floor. I'm forgetting. But regardless, there was this information station as well, and that ended up being another kind of hub where people would go to coordinate things that were happening and find people to help, etc. And so that was down there. The TA control room was upstairs. There were also other things that got set up, like there was a childcare area that was set up at one point, and people, volunteers for staffing so that you could, you know, have a place where kids could be and families could be. There were medic stations that got set up at some point, or at least a medic station, I could think it was. But there were medics anyway that were, you know, there and helping out. And different groups ended up stepping up, different unions and such stepping up to help kind of fill the Capitol with occupiers in different days, saying, okay, you know, we're going to do, you know, fill in the blank, whatever. We're going to take Saturday and make sure we get people there on Saturday or whatever. And so obviously some of us were there more or less constantly, but there were also infusions of different folks at different times. And there was one night I remember that was police, and I don't remember if that was the Madison police or who that was exactly, but I remember this kind of feeling of, I don't know, just appreciation for these cops that weren't covered under this bill actually stepping up like that. There were these also, like I think I mentioned, these sort of rolling, changing waves of restrictions on what you could bring into the Capitol, because at the very beginning there weren't any real restrictions, right, to speak of, but then there were different things that ended up getting banned at different points. And some of those ended up being rumors, or I'm not sure if really rumors, but at least not true in terms of the actual rules. Some of them probably were rumors, and some of them seemed to be decisions made by people that weren't actually people in charge. Things that you would think were coming from the Capitol Police, from Chief Tubbs. And then it would become clear later that they didn't come from him, but the other cops in the building would think that they came from him, and then once it got cleared up, they're like, oh, actually, I didn't come from him. So it kind of seemed like somebody was also spreading these, you know, saying, oh, this is the new rule that was coming from elsewhere. So we were suspicious it was probably somebody, you know, at least in some cases, maybe connected with Governor Walker, although we didn't have evidence to really say. There were also a lot of rumors. I mean, there were definitely a lot of rumors. Anytime you have that many people and their tents and everything, there's going to be rumors. And we definitely had a lot of rumors about, okay, tonight's the night they're going to kick us out, and this is going to happen, and that's going to happen. And so after a while, you started not taking the rumors too seriously, because it's like, yes, but we were just talking about this. Like, we thought that was going to happen last night or whatever. So there was definitely these different kind of rumors about what was going to happen. Do you want me to maybe wrap up there? It's about the time you needed to finish.
Yeah, I think we're at 10:15. So obviously we need to do at least one more, and we'll talk, you know, either after this or sort of via email about how we want to structure that next session, which might be the last session, or there might be one more.
Okay, that sounds good.
So this concludes this interview. So thank you, Kaya, for your time. I appreciate it.